Welcome to this week's special Shir on Hanukkah. What's interesting about trying to give a Shir on Hanukkah in the context of a Nach Shir is that Hanukkah is particularly difficult to give a Nach Shir on, simply because Hanukkah is not explicitly really mentioned in Nach. Unlike its sister holiday, Purim, the other rabbinic holiday which we celebrate on an annual basis, which has a Megillah, which is explicitly in the Ksuvim, Hanukkah really is at best hinted to in a few occasions in the Torah. There's some very fascinating parallels or dedications going on earlier. There's some connections to the menorah, to Shivas Tzion and Chagah and Zechariah. But really, on the whole, Hanukkah is somewhat omitted from the Tanakh itself. So thinking about Hanukkah in the context of Tanakh always becomes an interesting exercise. I'd like to start off with three questions. The questions which relate to Hanukkah, and perhaps will give us a foot in the door towards understanding the connection of it to the very parashios that we stand in right now. The first question comes, and you can see this in the sources. The source on page 1, source 1, is the Shulchan Aruch, which is the halacha regarding Neiros Hanukkah, the candles of Hanukkah, which happens to be a unique halacha to Hanukkah. There's very few other halachas which even resemble this halacha, and it goes as follows. Let's say there's a person who hasn't lit and won't be lighting that night. And there's nobody lighting for him at his house. When he sees, he's walking down the street and he sees the lights of Hanukkah, he can say the bracha of She'asar Nisim. He's not going to say the bracha of lighting the candles, because that he's not doing. But even upon just seeing the Neros Hanukkah, he will say the bracha of She'asar Nisim. And if it happens to be the first night, he also say the bracha of Shechiyana, which we do on the first night. Very fascinating halacha. In fact, the Aruch HaShulchan says that even if somebody is lighting for him in his house, let's say a person's on a trip, a person's on a boat ride, a person's on an airplane, and his wife or somebody else, or if it's a lady traveling, if her husband's lighting for her at home, and then they see a Chanukah licht in the window, they will say this Birkas HaRoah, a very fascinating bracha. What separates this from many, many other occasions of halacha is that when else do we ever find that you say a bracha simply on seeing? Somehow seeing seems to make it part of your experience enough to even elicit a bracha. You're somehow connected to the experience of Neros Chanukah just by sight. Just by sight, there's some form of connection to Neros Chanukah. And one would like to understand why that is. What is special and unique about Chanukah that has this connection to sight? If we continue, the Gemara in Shabbos, which discusses Chanukah, and again, much like Nach actually, the Gemara or the Talmud Bavli is very much empty or devoid of explicit discussion about Chanukah. Chanukah comes up in a few Mishnahs here and there. And in the Gemara, there's really about two pages in Gemara in Shabbos in the Perek of Bamei Madlikim, which discusses the candles of Shabbos. But it's tucked away, hidden, as opposed to, let's say, even Purim, which has an entire Masechta discussing the laws of Purim. Chanukah, again, is very much tucked away. And in the middle of this, as it turns from Chof Aleph, Amud Beis, to Chof Beis and Aleph, this is in Source 2, the Gemara says as follows. Darash Rabbi Nosson Bar Menyumi, Mishmei de Rabbi Tanchum, Mer Shal Chanukah She'enicho Lamalim Me'esrim Amat Psula, Kesuka Ukumavoy. If a person were to place a menorah above 20 amos, we're talking about roughly 30 feet, a menorah which is placed that high will not be kosher. It will not be a kosher menorah. This means to say that even if you lower it afterwards, it's not going to work because the lighting was in an inappropriate place. And what's the significance? What's the reason of this halacha, which is brought in Shulchan Aruch as well? The reasoning is because you're not able to see it. It's not in your, we'll call it, noticeable vision range. Now, people certainly are able to see beyond 20 amos on a healthy person or a person with glasses, but it's noticeable vision, meaning a person would not be paying attention to notice things above that range or that field. And this is Nogel HaLocha. This means to say that when you put place your menorah, you need to make sure if you're in a high rise building, this is a Nogel HaLocha, and one should consult a rabbi about where the best place to put it in such a case is. But there seems to be some connection again of sight to the menorah. Again, the menorah has to be placed in a particular position, in which the passers-by on the ground will be able to see it. Again, this connection to sight, which, if you bump into it twice in one section, is obviously indicative of a greater rule or idea. And I would like to try and understand that. But what's more fascinating is actually the continuation of the Gemara. Because the Gemara continues with a statement in the name of the same people. Vamar Rav Kahana, Rav Kahana quotes, Darash Rav Nosson bar Minyomi Mishmeda Rabbi Darav Tanuchum. Again, this is the same people who just said the previous comment. The same Rabbanim who just said the previous comment about the menorah being above 20 amos, not functioning as a menorah. And they say, My dirsiv, what is the pasuk which says, Va'abor reik, ein boy mayim, the pit is empty, it has no water. This is a pasuk by where? This is a pasuk by Yosef. In last week's parsha in Parshas Vayeshev, when Yosef is thrown into the pit by his brothers, it says that that pit was empty and it had no water. Mimashma sheneemar va'abor reik, ein yoder she'en bo mayim. Would it not have been sufficient just to tell me that it's empty and I would know that there's no water in it? Ela, ma tamud lame, what does the pasuk convey to us? Ein bo mayim, mayim ein boy, avon nechoshim akrovim yesh boy. The second phrase of that pasuk, which is, ein bo mayim, modifies the idea of reik. What type of emptiness is it? It's a modified emptiness. Only the type of emptiness which precludes water, but there could have been other things in it. And what were those things? Perhaps scorpions, snakes, which adds a little twist in the story of trying to understand what was going on with Yosef over there. And of course, we understand that when the Gemara was edited and brought to its final text as we have it, it's not by chance that these two halachas are lined up back to back. Why would it be that when Ravina Rav Ashi, when putting the Gemara together, would see fit to put this story of Yosef, which occurs at this time of year, right now, in connection to Hanukkah, when there seems to be no logical or apparent connection between the two statements, besides the fact that they were said by the same person? So again, to revise, there seems to be a connection between sight, vision, and Hanukkah, where we see there's a Birkas HaRo'eh, where you see the candles, and number two, where the menorah has to be placed within a certain range of noticeable vision. Why that is so, and number two is why it is connected to the story of Yosef about the pit being empty and by Mayim. In order to understand this properly, in order to give a sense of connection between this time of year and the events which occurred during this time of year, one would really need to understand a particular essay which was written by Rav Kook, recorded in Shmias HaRa'ayah. There's some drushes that he gave. There's a very fascinating and profound idea which he expands. I'm going to be adding on from both the ideas of Rav Avram Rivlin, the Mashgiach of Keren Biavne, Rav David Miller, who's also the Mashgiach of YU, and just some personal ideas as we go along to try to understand what is going on with Yosef on his own terms and coming back to try to appreciate what's going on in Hanukkah. So we start at the beginning. We have at the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev a rising tension between the brothers. Yosef is given a coat. Yosef is seemed to be favored. He's ben zakunim of his father. And then when he presents his dreams to the brothers, if you take a look in Source 3, after telling them the second dream in which they're going to be bound down to him, Vayomru lo yachov, his brothers say to him, Hamaloichtim lo yacholeno, are you going to rule over us? Imashaltim shalbonu, do you want to have dominion over us? Vayasufu od sonoosa, they continued to hate him. Al chalamoso v'al dvorov, on his dreams and on his words. Hate is a very big word. There's been other occasions of hate and tension between brothers beforehand, but for much more serious things. When Yaakov, in Esav's eyes, stole from him the blessings, that was something which burned Esav up to the extent that he wanted to kill Yaakov. But that was Yaakov actually doing something. He also seems to be innocently presenting these dreams. Remember, they're young men at this point, presenting these dreams. What is the cause of such a tangible hatred? But it gets worse. The Sforna describes in a few psukim later, the Sforna in Bereshis says, this is in Source 4, describes in the later pasuk their intent to kill. And it says as follows, Hine, higida kosuv, ki tziyaru belibom, v'choshvu es Yosef lenuchal umisnakesh benavshom lahamisom. The brothers viewed Yosef as somebody who was potentially going to kill them, plotting against their lives, either in this world, the next world, or both of them. Very strong terms. And what's their response? Torah Amra, the concept of the Torah, tells us, Habo lehargocho hashkem lehargoy. If somebody comes against you, chas v'shalom, with intent, with malintent to kill, you're allowed to and you're expected to defend yourself, even if it means taking the other person's life, ultimately. And therefore, in a certain sense, an act of self-defense, it seems to be the way that Sforin is describing it, they would try to kill him. Very puzzling. Very puzzling indeed. What exactly were they being threatened by? What about Yosef's existence threatened them to the extent that they felt justified to even kill him? What's really going on over here? Does it sit well with us? But the story begins even earlier. Because if we remember, at the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, at a point where Yaakov really has no children yet, Yaakov sets out from the place where he lives with his parents on the way to the house of Lavan. That night, he goes to sleep in a certain place, which is seems to be explicitly identified with Beis El. And that night he has the dream, the ladder, the whole, and the whole dream in which he sees the Shara Shamayim Hashem. What's interesting is that when he's going to sleep that night, we're familiar with the Medrash which describes that which explains the Psukim, explains the following. The Psukim start off by describing that he took a number of stones and he put them around his head, and at the end it talks about picking up a single stone, which seems to be a discrepancy. In explaining this, Rashi in Source 5, it quotes the Midrash which we've probably all heard about since a very young age, and it says, Vayosem Arashasov, he puts these stones around his head. Hischilu merivus zuimzu. The stones start fighting with one another. Zos omeris, this one says, Olai yoniach tzadik es Rashi, Roshoi. This one says, the tzadik will, Yaakov Avinu will put his head on me. Zos omeris, Olai yoniach. Other one says, no, it'll be on me. Miyad asana kosh baruchu even achas. Immediately, Hashem made them into one stone. V'zeo shenemar, this is what it says, v'yikach es ha'even asher sam mirash esav. That he took the even, the stone, which he placed by his head, meaning only one stone. We're very familiar with this story, the 12 stones, and turning into one stone. But there's an interesting twist in this, and this is actually found in the Bereshit Rabba on the spot, right over here at the beginning of Vayetze, in Samach Ches Yud Aleph. It adds a little twist to the story. It says as follows. This is in Source 6. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Shnei Misrei Avonim Notal. He took 12 stones. Why 12? Kach Gozar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem decreed, Shehu Ma'amid Shneim Osor Shvatim. That ultimately he's going to establish 12 tribes. Omar, Avram Lohim Yedom. My father Abraham my grandfather Abraham didn't establish these tribes. Yitzhak Lohim Yedom, Yitzhak also didn't establish the tribes. Ani, im misachosheim shnei masar avonim zulazu. If there's going to be cohesion, if there's going to be cooperation between these 12 stones, yodei ani shani mamid yod beishvatim. It is a sign that I'll be establishing these 12 tribes. Kevon shenisachu yod bezavonim zubazu. Since the stones did cooperate, in fact they became one stone, yoda shehu ma'amid yudbeis shvatim. He knew that he were to be the person to establish the 12 tribes. Because you see, up till now, it's been a one-man show. Up till now, it has been Abraham who's been the teacher, the express in society of monotheism, in the word of Hashem, at this point in time. He had two children. In fact, he had more children. But not all those children became part of his mission, became part of his destiny and legacy. Abraham sent out Ishmael with taking heed to his wife's voice, Sarah. She sent him out, and later on he sends out the Bnei Keturah to the east, establishing only one child as being that particular continuer or the progeny for his legacy. And Yitzhak, in a very different way to Abraham, with the Midah of Gevurah, also bears the torch of this nationhood, of the ideal, of the teachings of monotheism and the word of Hashem in the world. And again, he has more than one child. He has Yaakov and Esav. And he's very close to crowning both of them as part of his mission. Until his wife as well shows him or switches through the birka, the brachas, and excludes Esav from being part of this legacy. And there's Yaakov. And Yaakov over here is at the point where he's just realized this. He's become the legacy now of Yitzhak Avinu. And he's getting this message, and the message is telling him that you're not going to be only finding one child. You're going to have 12 children. And all those children are going to be somehow one. You're going to lead a mission which is now going to create a nation, not just a family. That's what Yaakov Avinu is being conveyed by the symbolism of the story which occurred to him. And now, the story of Yosef becomes a little clearer. Because even though there's going to be 12 tribes, the question between the stones and so too in real life is, who will a tzaddik place his head on? Who will Yaakov eventually place his head on? Who will be the leader? Who will set the tone of this nation if there are going to be 12 constituents? That's the question of the stones. And that's the question all these young adolescents also want to know. And when they see a person who presents dreams, and the dreams indicate that he's going to be the center and everybody else bowing to him, it means to say that he's saying that he will be the leader. He'll be setting the tone. And their question is, are you going to really be the king? Do you think your ideology, your way of life, is going to be the way that is going to lead the rest of the tribes? You're going to be the center stone? And they feel very threatened by that. Something about Yosef threatens them in the fact that he will be the leader. It's something which concerns them. What about Yosef's actions or his potential of being a leader threatens the brothers so much? It seems like the question at hand is, who is going to be the leader? Who is going to set the terms or set the tone of this nation, the B'nai Yisrael, these Shvatim? Because all of them want to be included. The question is, who's going to be leading? We need to understand the unique characters, the unique ways in which these different characters express themselves, to understand the tension of Parshas Vayeshev. Rav Kook points in the direction of their mothers. Before even trying to understand what's going on between the sons, between the brothers, one needs to understand the tension that is inherent first in the matriarchs themselves. In Source 8, quoting the Zohar, we talk about a particular passage which describes the difference between Rachel and Leah, the two primary wives of Yaakov Avinu. Aval raza de mila, the secret of the matter is, de Rachel ve Leah tre alminenu. Rachel and Leah are two worlds. Chad alma de iskasia, one is the world of the covered world. Chad alma de iskasia, and one is the revealed world. Va'al da is kaviras vischafias legoi ma'arto viskasias. Before we actually get there, the Zohar is making a claim that Rachel and Leah represent two modes within this world. One is the covered, the secret, and the one is the revealed. Rachel is the revealed one, the one out in the world, and Leah is the one who is hidden. How does this express? Before even getting further in the Zohar, where do we see this expressed? What do we know about them that may give rise to such a theory? Well, the first thing one should notice is the first of the sisters, even though she's younger, we meet first, is the one who is leaving the house with the flocks. It's not Leah who's leading the flocks when Yaakov meets her at the well, it's Rachel. Very fascinating. Point number two. What do we know about their looks? What do we know about the way which Rachel and Leah look? Well, we only know about what Rachel looks like. The Torah tells us that she was Yafas Toyar. She was a beautiful lady. We don't know anything about what Leah looked like. All we know is that Eineha Rakos, that her eyes, Einei Leah Rakos, the eyes of Leah were soft. What does that mean? Does it mean that she had dimmed vision? Does it mean to say that she was crying? Many different ideas in it, but we're not told about much about her. We told about our eyes. Very fascinating. Somehow, something more hidden. When the Torah doesn't even tell us about her description. Interesting point. But the Zohar takes it even to the next level. The Zohar explains, and this is going on, that is why Leah was put into the Maras HaMachpelah, into the hidden chambers of a Maras HaMachpelah, the Dor, but Rachel, the other one, whereas Rachel's left not just on the roads, but at the crossroads. Rachel is left at the crossroads entering Israel. Because of this yesod, this truth, this deep truth of differentiating between the two of them, Yaakov never brought her in to the Maris HaMachpelah in any other place because he knew that Rachel represented this and it was important for her to be there. Because he knew that Rachel belonged in the place which is revealed. And ultimately, we know that there was a very important purpose of Rachel being out there on the crossroads. Because in a number of centuries' time, as Israel is leaving, as they're being exiled, in the first exile, Yirmiyahu tells us that Rachel mevako al boneo. Rachel cries on her children who walk past her at the crossroads. The nation of Israel, as they leave the place of, in a sense, concealment, their safe haven of Israel, and they're about to be taken out into the rest of the world, Rachel's there to protect them. Because she was the person who was buried at the crossroads. She was the person who lived her life outside. She lived outside of Israel and was buried on the border. The Iskalia, in the revealed place. Whereas Leah is safely hidden in Maris HaMachpelah. Two different ways, two different modes of operation within this world. And this expresses itself in the children. Because Leah and Rachel had children. And they had one particular child each who represented their particular idea in this world. Rachel's firstborn, of course, is Yosef, to represent her ideal. And the firstborn of Leah, although being Reuven in name, as we know later on in by the brachos of Yaakov, really lost his firstborn right in a number of different ways to different people. And the kingship went from Reuven to Yehuda. Yehuda became the propagator, or the representative of the ideal of Rachel in this world. And let's examine those two characters just for a moment. What we know about Yosef in his later career, what he actually became, not at this point in time, not in his youth, when the arguments are rife, what happened at a later point in time? We know that Yosef is a successful man in adversity. He arrives at Potiphar's house, he succeeds. He becomes the big cheese in that house. He goes to a prison, even amid a prison. He becomes the person to deal with the new inmates. And then he moves to become a viceroy of Egypt, a very powerful position, which Chazal tell us at a certain point later he even was able to bring circumcision to all of the Egyptians because he controlled the land. Everybody sold themselves to him in the days of the famine. He owned almost the entire known powerful world in the Near East. As you see in Source 9, when he sends the message to Yaakov, Ko'amar bincha Yosef, when he tells his father what he's done, he says, Somani Elokim la'adon l'chol Mitzrayim. God has given me as the Adon, the ruler of all Mitzrayim. And this wasn't just that he won the lottery. It wasn't that he was just a lucky person. This was his way of operation. Yosef's ideal was like Rachel, but now even more express, is being in the world, is taking that world, going out into it, making it better, improving the place that you're at, be it your employer, be it a prison, or be it the most powerful country in the world at the time. Yosef goes and fixes, he integrates, and he improves. That's what Yosef is. That's why later when Hosea Torah describes Ephraim, which is a term for the northern kingdom, which is often dubbed under the name Ephraim, Hosea says, this is in Source 10, Ephraim bo'amim yihu yispolal. Ephraim will mix among the nations, will mingle with the people, like Yosef. Yosef mingled. Yosef was among. Yosef was integrated in the rest of the world and bringing about a tremendous Kiddush Hashem via his actions. Whereas when we consider Yehuda, one event which is particularly identifying of his characteristic is later on in Vayigash, when Yaakov is sending down or coming down with the whole of his family, he sends Yehuda ahead to Goshen. In the Midrash Tanchuma, which is in Source 11, comments, Dover Acher ve'es Yehuda sholach lefonov el Yosef lehoros lefonov. Why did he send Yehuda in front of to teach ahead of him? Ma'o, what is this? Omri ben Nechemya lehaskin loy beis Talmud shehei shom moire Torah. He was sent to create a yeshiva, an academy, that they should be teaching of Torah, a school system. Shehu hashvatim hoigim Torah, that they should be learning Torah. Not just learning Torah, but there should be an infrastructure when they arrive. This is very different to Yosef. Yosef was thrown into the deep end. He didn't have an infrastructure. He created his success in the place that he was with the help of Hashem. Yehuda is Yaakov's agent of creating a safe haven, of making sure it's safe before you jump into something new. That was Yehuda. Yehuda operated within the walls. Two very different ideologies. Yosef from Rachel of Alma Dis Galia, the revealed world, and Yehuda from Leah, Alma Dis Kasia, the hidden world, the preserved, the conserved world. And apparently, the brothers felt very threatened. The brothers felt very threatened by Yosef's way of leading. Because Yosef was telling them, I will be the leader in his dreams. And with his approach to life, they knew that adversity presents a great amount of risk. Getting involved in the rest of the world presents a very big risk to survival, almost to the point of suicide. And they were very concerned about this, not just because of Yosef's dreams, because Yosef was also a Ben Zakunim to his father. What does Ben Zakunim mean? Rashi presents a number of ideas of what Ben Zakunim can mean. But in Source 12, focusing on one of them, very fascinating, says Ben Zakunim, he was a son of his old age, Shinola lo lezignoso, because he was born in his old age, which could include Binyamin as well, but for Unklus Tirgame, Unklus translates Barachakim Hule. He was a wise son to him. Kol ma shelomad mishem ve'ever mosar loy. Everything Yaakov learnt from the yeshiva of Shem and Ever, Yaakov transferred to Yosef. What does that mean? Did Yaakov not teach the other tribes that he's the other son's Torah? Of course he did. Did Yaakov not learn Torah himself in his life before he went to Shem ve'ever? Of course he did. He lived many decades in the house of Yitzhak. He pondered the metaphysical truths of the world. He looked into nature and saw God under the tutelage of his father. What was the Torah about of Shem Ever? At which point in Yaakov's life did Yaakov himself engage in the Torah of Shem Ever? At a very critical point. At the point where Yaakov is about to step out into the world of Lavan. On the way from Israel to Charan, Yaakov stops off in the Yeshiva Shem Ever, tells us the Midrash. Because apparently the Torah of Shem Ever is not the Torah of within the tent, it's the Torah which helps cope and succeed in the world which can be very crooked outside of the four corners, of the four walls of the Beis Midrash. And Yaakov teaches Yosef the same Torah, because Yaakov very clearly understood that his son Yosef was on this track. And this really worried the brothers. Because if the leadership is going to be under a Yosef, it could be suicide. There are those who will lose out by a plan of integration, full integration, which Yosef seems to be preserving. And what's the reaction? The reaction comes from two particular brothers, Shimon and Levi. Of course, now, not sons of Rachel, but sons of Leah. We know Shimon and Levi. We know these people described as Ishla al-Achibachiv, that these two people consult beforehand. They reacted in a previous incident, and that was the incident of the rape of their sister Dina, the previous parashiyos. And what's fascinating is that On the one hand, in the rape of Dina, they're simply reacting to the rape, and as they say at the end, how can I treat her, be treated in such a disrespectful, terrible, degrading fashion? But at the same time, they're also reacting to the proposition of Shechem and Chamor. Because remember, what was the proposition of Shechem and Chamor? We'll marry your daughters. Your daughters will marry us. Let's integrate. Let's become one big nation. We'll share our cattle. We'll become one big trading nation. The reaction of the B'nai Leah, of the Alma de Iskasya, of the people who contained, who want to preserve this special unit of this nation of Israel, react viscerally and they kill, destroy anybody who presents such a proposition. And again, it's fascinating that it's them, who are the people who want to take action to eliminate, to eradicate the idea of having somebody as such a leader. The person who's going to be the rock which the tzaddik will place his head. They're terrified of having a Yosef there because they feel suicide for the enterprise of B'nai Yisrael as a whole. That's what Shimon HaLevi proposed. But Rakuk explains so beautifully. When Yehuda decides to sell Yosef, it isn't simply a ploy to try to save his life, as we're used to thinking. It was a much more profound statement. Yehuda says to his brothers, the B'nai Leah, who are the instigators of the sale of the killing of Yosef, he says, if Yosef really believes in what he professes, the idea of integration, the idea of being able to go out into the world and succeed and remain upright, then let's test it. Let's sell him out to wherever he ends up and let's see what actually occurs. Will he succeed or will his mission be his very undoing? Yehuda is proposing that let's test the mettle of Yosef. Let's sell him and see exactly what does happen. And what does happen? Yosef succeeds incredibly. Wherever he goes, he succeeds. He overcomes the travails and the challenges to his way of operation. And ultimately, at the end of the story, there seems to be a sense of respect for each other. The brothers respect the fact that Yosef is the king, and Yosef, when bringing them down to Egypt, tells them that they can live in Eretz Goshen, in a place set aside, further away from Egypt in and of itself, respecting the fact that not everybody needs to be led in one particular way, that they can have their spot. There's a mutual respect between them at the end of the story. Once they've each side has lived out their particular strengths. But we should notice that there is a caveat. Yosef doesn't just succeed in a vacuum. There is a condition to the success of Yosef, of being an Or Lagoyim, of being this light unto the nations from within, from within the nations, among them. And that is connection of sight. Because if you remember, Yosef actually maybe almost doesn't make it. Yosef is challenged to the point that he almost doesn't succeed being so far from home, away from the morals of his father's house. And that is in the house of Potiphar. In the house of Potiphar, we know that he is seduced by the lady of the house, Potiphera. And in this incident, what saved him? What brought Yosef through that he was able to succeed under such conditions? The Gemara in Sota on in source 14 says as follows, "Vatispaseh v'vigdo v'lemor." She grabbed him by his coat. But Oysashah, at this crucial moment, is Yosef going to succeed? Is he going to live up to his mission or is he going to fail? Yosef saw the vision of his father in the window. Omar loy, and this vision said to him, Yosef, your brothers are going to be written on the stones of the Choshen, and you are supposed to be among them. Do you want that your name be erased from that because you run after prostitutes, because you're not able to control yourself? And he was able to overcome. At this very crucial moment, what saved Yosef amidst the darkness, amidst the loneliness of being away from the morals of his home, is the fact that he could still envision his father. is the fact that he could still remember and clearly see his father in the window and remember the values that they stood for. Yosef needed to be connected through vision. And the Gemara in Zvachim, this is in source 15, in fact tells us that he was given the bracha of Ale Oyen, that he was given the bracha of being above the eye. What does it mean above the eye? It means that he was able to overcome his physical vision of the seduction of the mistress of his master, and thereby get the bracha of Ayin, of sight. What bracha of sight did Yosef get? And this is such a beautiful idea that Rav Kook points out, which is a Mishnah early on in Zvachim, which describes the difference between two places where Hashem resided. Because in the end, it wasn't just Yosef and Yehuda. In the end, when the Jews entered Israel for the first time, the Hashem resided in two places. One was the Mikdash in the Chelek of Yehuda, and one was the Mishkan in Shiloh, in Har Ephraim, in the mountains of Ephraim in Yosef's portion. And to put things in perspective, the Mishkan in Shiloh was there for 369 years, a very long time, almost an equal amount of time that it was in the Mikdash for the first Mikdash. Two different locations, and these different locations had different halachas. And look carefully and consider carefully the differences between these two locations, which perhaps express this very message, the condition that Yosef has. This is in source 13, it's the Talmud in Zvachim, it's actually a Mishnah. Ba'u l'Shiloh, they came to Shiloh, ne'esra abamos. When the Mishkan arrived at Shiloh, the personal altars were made asur, v'lohoyo shom tikra, there was no ceiling there, elabeis avonim bilvad, milamaton, v'hayirios milamalon. They abandoned the wooden structure that they carried around in the desert. They had a stone structure with curtains above it. V'hi ha'isa menucha. This was a resting place for Hashem. Kodshim kodashim, the holy of holies. These are meats which could only be eaten by the Mizbeach or the Kohanim. Ne'echolim lifnim min ha'kolayim, could only be eaten within the curtains. V'kodshim kodashim, the meat with less, the korbanos which had a lesser sanctity, for instance, the shlamim, where the owners could even eat, for instance, a Thanksgiving offering, a tola, that kind of meat could be eaten by the owners where? U'maizasheni and maizasheni b'chol haroe, in vision sight, meaning, Shiloh was on a mountain, any area which was in sight of Shiloh was sanctified enough, or connected enough, that it could be either the Kodshim Kalim could be eaten there. However, look at the other side. Bold Yerushalayim, when they came to Jerusalem, this is the Mikdash now, Ne'es Rabamos, once again, the personal altars were made Asr, because there was a gap between Shiloh and in Yerushalayim. V'lohoy Elohim Heter, and they were never allowed again. V'hi Ha'sa Ha'nachalah. This was the inheritance, not just the Menucha, the resting place of Hashem, this was the inheritance. Kodshim Kadoshim Ne'echolim Nifnim Ha'klaim, the Kodshim Kadoshim, the holy meat, which was from higher level korbanos, which could only be eaten by Kohanim, could be eaten once again in the klaim, in the curtains, within the curtains. Kodshim kalim u'maisa sheni lifnim menachoma. You could only eat kodshim kalim, the meat which the owners could eat, where? Within the wall. Isn't that a fascinating difference? When it comes to the kodshim kalim, in the Mishkan and Shiloh, in Yosef's portion, you could eat it wherever you could see Shiloh, the Mishkan in Shiloh. Isn't it fascinating? Because apparently the connection of vision, you could be far away, you could be out of the Mishkan and still be able to eat it as long as you have the connection of sight. As long as you're held there with this connection of sight. This is the symbolic Demus Diyun Koshel Aviv. This is the sight that saves Yosef even when he's out of the Mishkan, even when he's out of his father's house, as long as he's connected by sight. Whereas Yehuda operates differently. Yehuda, you can only eat something holy when you're in a holy place. You're within the choma, within the wall. It needs to be in the base midrash, like Yehuda sets up the base midrash as he goes down to Egypt. The two very different modes of operation, and the caveat within Yosef, that it needs to be within the range of vision. And this becomes very fascinating. This becomes very fascinating because in the end, how is Klal Yisrael supposed to operate? Well, if you look at the Haftorah of Parshas Vayigash, I quoted a few psukim over here in Source 7. This is the Haftorah in Vayigash from Yecheskel, Perek Lamed Zayin. There's a beautiful description, and it goes as follows. Va'ato ben Adam, and you, son of man, which is the way Hashem addresses Yechezkel very often. Kach lecha etz echad k'sov olel liYehuda v'livnei Yisrael chaverov ulekach etz echad k'sov olel liYosef etz Ephraim v'chobeis Yisrael chaverov. Take two pieces of wood, rot on the one of them, Ephraim, and rot on the other piece of wood, symbolically Yehuda. V'koravosam kol echad el echad. Bring the two together. Le'etz echad. They should be one. V'ayu la'achadim biyadecha. They should be one in your hand. V'kasher yamru elecha b'nei amecha le'mor haloi sagid lanu mo'ele loch. And when the people ask you, what are you doing, Yechezkel? Like many of the other actions that Yechezkel did in his lifetime. Daber elayhem ko amar Hashem. You should speak to them and say as follows. This is what Hashem says. Hineni lukeach es etz Yosef asher biyad Ephraim v'shivtei Yisrael chavirov. V'nosati yosam alov es etz Yehuda v'asisim le'etz echad v'ayu be'echad biyadi. I'm going to take these two woods and put them together. V'ahoyu etzim asher tichtov aleihem biyadcha le'inehem. You shall show these woods to their eyes. V'daber aleihem and say to them, Ko amar Hashem. So says God, Hinei. Ani lokeach es b'nei Yisrael mibein hagoyim. I'm going to take the nation of Israel from among the nations. Asher holchu sham, that they went among them. V'kibatzti osam misavi v'heveisi osam el admosam. I'm going to bring them to their ground, to their territory. V'asisi osam l'goy echad ba'aretz. They're going to be one nation when the Mashiach comes. Ba'arei Yisrael, in the hills of Israel, melech echad yilu kulam l'melech. And there'll be one king of them. V'lo yu od shlishnei goyim. There will no longer be two nations. V'lo yechotzu od lishnei mamlochos. There will not be two kingdoms. Meaning that it's supposed to be that the nation of Israel has different elements. And like Yosef could respect that Yehuda and the rest of the tribes needed Goshen, a separate place from Egypt, and they could respect him as being the ruler and the sustainer of the world among the nations, and being the diplomat, and being the parliamentarian. So too the nation of Israel is supposed to ultimately be, that there is this one nation with different disparate parts. But the twist comes when it comes to Chanukah. Because the Midrash famously tells us in the last source here in source 16, the Vayikra Rabbah, so it appears in Bereshit Rabbah as well, that the Greeks said, what was their claim against the nation of Israel? Kisu lachem al keren ha-shor, she'en lachem chelek b'elokei Yisrael. Should write on the ox of the shore, of the ox's horn, that you have no chelek in the Elokei Yisrael. Who is the representative? Who is symbolic of the shore among the nation of Israel? Well, in Moshe's blessing of the nation of Israel, it is Yosef. B'chor sharoi hadaloi. The firstborn ox, hadaloi, has beauty. What was Greece saying? Greece was saying, we like this idea of integration. In fact, we like it so extreme, we don't want any boundaries. We want it to be complete integration. Hellenize, adopt our culture. Become one like us. In fact, the Mishnah tells us that they broke 13 holes in the wall called the Soireg, which divided the place where the non-Jews could enter into the Mikdash. They broke down the wall of Yehuda in the Mikdash, trying to adopt a twisted idea of Yosef, of integration. Again, an integration which Yosef himself never intended or wanted. And who came to fix it? Who fixed this break? It was the Chashmonaim. Beis Chashmonai, which was from Shevet Levi, the Kohanim. Because when Yosef is twisted, when his idea is manipulated, it requires somebody from the B'nai Leia, again, the people who focus against or just who put into place anti-integration, to be able to set it straight again. That's the Chashmonaim coming in the end to be able to say this. That's perhaps why it is that these two Gemaras are juxtaposed. The whole story of the sale of Yosef was really about what way are we supposed to operate among the nations? How are we supposed to be? Are we supposed to be allowed among the nations in among ourselves? Or among them? How do we create Kiddush Hashem in the world? And that's why it is that Chanukah needs to be within sight. The menorah is the chi of Ner Ishu Vesai, of each house. But at the same time, it's supposed to be seen. And so much is supposed to be seen that there's even a specific bracha on sight of the menorah. Even just seeing it. Because it's a correction. You may be able to have some form of integration, but the question is, are you within sight? Do you have the Kol HaRoe of Shiloh? Do you have Dumus Yudin Kol HaRoe of Shal Yosef? If that's your way. If that's your particular way. And this is something which moves its way through history. These two modes, being among ourselves, being in the realm of the Goyim, and bringing light to them among them. I think it's fascinating, if you just turn to the last page for a moment, two pictures worth thinking about. The first is the picture of a medal, which has got the head and the name of Alfred Nobel. Nobel was in fact the inventor of dynamite, an extremely, incredibly rich and successful man. And actually somebody mistakenly thought that he had died and wrote an obituary about him. And talked about him in very negative terms, about being the master of death, bringing dynamite and explosives to the world. And he was so shocked by this episode that he decided to change his life's mission, and he was awoken to create the Nobel Prize Society, which he created prizes for people who excelled in developing and making the world a better place. What's fascinating is that we know, it's perhaps common knowledge, that 20% of the Nobel laureates are in fact Jewish. That's a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. The fact that somehow integral to the nation of Israel is the fact that we can make a difference in the world as a whole, that we can make the world a better place, be it in literature, be it in physics, astrophysics, medicine, economics, that somehow there's this ingrained place among the nation of Israel to make a difference in the world. That's a Kiddush Hashem of one style, of integration, or the most extreme form. But then there's another Kiddush Hashem, and that's Shabbos. When Jonathan Sachs was recently in Chicago, a year ago, in October time, he mentioned a story where he was doing a program on education and family. Nothing to do with Judaism, and he had a particular expert in this, a particular expert called Dr. Penelope Leach, a British author, of many books of child development, and she was working on the program with him, and he decided on a Friday to take her to one of the elementary and primary schools there in England to show her what was like at a Jewish school. And it happened to be that they were doing a Shabbos party, you know, where you have these 5-year-olds, the 5-year-old Bubby giving the 5-year-old grandchild a brocha, and the 5-year-old Imma giving the rest of the 5-year-old children Kiddush. And she spoke to the children afterwards, after seeing this, the first exposure to anything of the sort, and she said to the children, "What do you like about Shabbos? What don't you like?" And this little one says, "You know, I hate Shabbos because I can't watch television." The other one says, "You know what I love about Shabbos? I love about Shabbos is that Daddy doesn't have to run away. Daddy doesn't have to always run to catch a phone call." And as she walked out, she said to the chief rabbi, "Chief rabbi, that Shabbos of yours is saving the parents' marriage." And why were they keeping Shabbos? They're keeping Shabbos to show the rest of the world? No, they and we keep Shabbos because it's a mitzvah. It's part of the way we act in and among ourselves, not to show anybody. But when somebody peeps in the window and sees that, and sees the beauty of what it can be, that's a Kiddush Hashem from within. A Kiddush Hashem from without, and a Kiddush Hashem within. These two modes of operation that take us all the way through history. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful night.